You are listening to Arrive by the Cycling Podcast.
All right, Lionel, how you doing?
Oh, dear.
I mean, we're going to do the whole podcast thing in Glaswegian.
Your dad is Scottish, so...
He's Scottish, from very close to the root, Lionel, from very close to a point where, well, something significant happened in today's World Championship road race, which we will discuss later, no doubt.
My Scottish ancestry, my Scottish ancestry goes back a little bit further, so I'm not going to push it with a terrible accent, nor am I going to make a comment about the Scottish summer. I've got in trouble for that before. But there was a glimpse of Scottish summer this afternoon, wasn't there? It broke out in between the rain showers, but that was the crowd and the finish line commentary in Glasgow as Matthew van der Poel won the rainbow jersey in the men's road race, as recorded by Tom Whalley, who is up there in Glasgow this weekend.
He won the rainbow jersey in the Tennent Super Race, the World Urban Cyclocross Championship, the Edinburgh, Glasgow, 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 Glasgow.
It was a Criterium Championships, really, wasn't it? It was a very, it was kind of harking back to the British tradition of city centre Criterium racing. It could have been a super edition of a Kellogg's City Centre Criterium from the 80s or the Friends Providence series. I'm sure you remember that, Daniel, from the 90s. Or more recently, the Tour series. I think I've been reflecting on this in the couple of hours since the race finished. And I think it's good that there are different flavours of World Championship road races. And I suppose if the whole point of the race is to bring the best riders in the world, the best one-day riders in the world, to the fore and have them battle it out for the rainbow jersey. Well, it completely ticked that box, didn't it? I had some reservations about the course itself and about the kind of... There was a period where the race slipped into a bit of a lull and I wasn't particularly enjoying it as a spectacle. But the important bit of the race was gripping, wasn't it?
Well, I think maybe people would have expected us to poo-poo the race and poo-poo this World Championships, but no, it was an absolute, well, it was a rip-snorter of a race. And I tell you who did enjoy it, Lionel, who will have enjoyed it, the team physiologists, because there's a lot there for them to sort of conjure with, or there will be when they look at the riders' training peaks files and Strava files. The first Strava files have started to come in, I've noticed. Talking of what kind of World Championship it was, I think Lawson Craddock's Strava file was entitled the World Criterium Championships, he's called it. Talking about physiologist, team coaches, Fred Grapp, who's sort of the head physiologist at Groupama, was certainly very enthused. He said, this World Championship is exceptional because it stimulates very high levels of all the physical qualities exploited in cycling. Explosiveness, lactic tolerance, maximal power, threshold endurance, and a very high cognitive activity, which alters all physical potential. A crazy race. That cognitive dimension is an interesting one, isn't it? Because we heard few riders in the days leading up to the race, the guys who had sort of arrived Thursday and Friday who had tested the course, talk about just how dizzying it was. And Julien Alaphilippe, for example, said that he never had any idea where he was in this labyrinth because it was very difficult to sort of orientate oneself. There weren't the usual reference points that we get in a World Championship. They're usually based around, the circuits are usually based around one climb, one significant climb that then sort of remain ingrained in our memory when we think back to World Championships of yore. We think back, we remember some of the names, don't we? The Wampers climb, for example, at Leuven a couple of years ago, but there have been many others over the years. And, okay, we had Montrose Street here, but there weren't too many sort of strong kind of visual reference points, were there?
No, they weren't really. And I suppose that is a little bit like a criterium. When watching a crit on TV, you sort of recognise buildings or a certain corner or a little stretch. But for the riders themselves, you know, when you have that sort of 20-minute lap, normally there's a much kind of slower ebb and flow to a world championship course, whereas this was frenetic. Pretty much as soon as they reached that circuit, it was just corner, sprint, corner, sprint. And I mean, it must have been pretty hellish to ride. And I suppose that is why the cream came to the top, wasn't it? The best riders in the world were able to cope with that relentless kind of ramping up of pressure, because being at the back of a group of 20 was okay for a period of time until suddenly the gaps started to open and the effort required to close those gaps coming out of the corners became more significant as it went on. And it was obviously going to break up and come down to a smaller group of riders. I suppose my reservation was once they reached the circuit and there was a kind of the first orientation phase where they were getting to grips with it, the race did then fall into a couple of sort of lulls where even though the riders at the front were, you know, the biggest names, there was a sense that it was a sort of phony war, wasn't there really? But maybe I should just run through some of the highlights of quite a difficult day's racing to get a handle on. You know, if the riders struggled to orientate themselves and work out where they were in the race, I think as a spectator, it was similar. But Mathieu van der Poel is the first Dutchman to win the World Championships men's road race since Joep Zoetemelk in 1985. And he adds the rainbow jersey to the one he won in the cyclocross at the start of the year. I mean, pretty much no contest when it comes to assessing the best one-day rider of the year, because he's also won Milan-San Remo and Paris-Roubaix earlier in the spring. Glasgow itself, well, it was the rainbow city, wasn't it? Because it was raining heavily at one point, then the sun was coming out, and then the rain came again. There, in fact, was a rainbow over the city at one stage. And, I mean, if I'm feeling a little bit smug, it's because in our preview, I did kind of steal Renaud Schotter's point that the course and the style of racing would suit Mathieu van der Poel. But I did also say...
You did extremely well on the predictions. Poor Renaud, of course, predicted that Jasper Philipsen would win. And Jasper Philipsen, unfortunately, cemented himself to the road at some point around about when the main peloton came into Glasgow. Anyway, Lionel, you were saying...
He did. Well, yeah, I kind of made a point that if the top eight from this year's Tour of Flanders were the top eight here, it wouldn't necessarily be a surprise. And there was that period, wasn't there, for about 30-odd kilometres where this year's top four from the Tour of Flanders were chasing the 2019 Tour of Flanders winner, Alberto Bettiol. But as a race itself, I think the first 100 or so K, or certainly until they got to Glasgow, was a little bit more predictable and formulaic than I'd perhaps anticipated when we were talking about the race earlier in the week. There were the usual flurry of attacks early on, but nothing stuck until a break of nine went away, and in it were Owain Doull of Great Britain, Matt Dinham of Australia, Harold Tejada of Colombia, Kevin Vermaak of the USA, Patrick Gamper of Austria, Rory Townsend of Ireland, Ryan Christensen of New Zealand, Chris Nylands of Latvia, and Petr Kelleman of the Czech Republic. For a while, there was a little counter move that had George Bennett of New Zealand in it, and the break got around 7-8 minutes over the peloton at its maximum. But of course, the big incident in the first half of the race was the protest, which brought the race to a halt with around 192 kilometres to go, just as they were reaching those key climbs on the stretch from Edinburgh to Glasgow. Now, an organisation called This Is Rigged have taken responsibility for the protest. This is a Scottish group opposing all new fossil fuel projects in and around Scotland. So perhaps predictable that the race would be disrupted, particularly coming on the back of the British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak announcing that hundreds of new licences to explore for new oil and gas will be issued in the near future. Five protesters have been arrested. We'll perhaps talk a bit more about that in the second part. Back to the race, and the leaders were around 3 minutes 45 ahead still when they reached the Glasgow circuit. If I run through what happened in the first sort of 50, 60K in Glasgow, we'll be here all night. There were about 100 attacks. The Belgian played all of their cards one after the other. Remco Evenepoel, the defending champion, of course, was very aggressive. I mean, he was really eye-catching, wasn't he? Because he was yo-yoing from the front group. And then next thing you knew, he was off the back of the chase group. Then the lead group started to get caught. Kevin Vivekka of the USA went clear on his own, and there were a few key incidents that happened behind. Matteo Trentin crashed into the barriers on Montrose Street as Tadej Pogacar launched one of his first attacks. And before we knew it, the group was down to around 25 riders chasing that break. And then the last 75 kilometres, there was the Mads Pedersen attack. That forced clear the group, which contained pretty much everyone who was in the thick of the action at the end. But as I said at the start, it was a bit of a phony move, that one. But it foreshadowed what was to come. And when Vivek was eventually caught, Pedersen tried again. And that led to this kind of strange period where the race fell into a bit of a slumber until Alberto Bettiol, former Tour of Flanders winner, of course, attacked with 55 kilometres to go. The rain fell. He opened a lead of around 30, 40 seconds. And as the rain fell, it looked like that was going to play into his hands. Then there was a crash for Jonathan Narvaez of Ecuador, which led to a split in the chase group. And then all of a sudden, we had the big four chasing Bettiol. That was Van der Poel, Van Aert, Pogacar and Mads Pedersen, the 2019 world champion, of course. Behind them came Nielsen Paulus, Schmidt and Skuins. And, well, it was then a question of whether Bettiol would be able to stay clear. As I said, the rain looked like it might give him a chance, but the four worked pretty well together. And with 22 and a half kilometres to go, they had him in their sights. And that was the moment that Van der Poel chose to accelerate. I want to ask you a question because it struck me that the moment that they were catching Bettiol on a very Matthew Van der Poel friendly hill was absolutely critical, but we'll perhaps discuss that in a moment. Still time for plenty of drama, because although Van der Poel opened up that gap that looked pretty much unassailable, he fell on a slightly downhill right-hand corner. The roads were wet and slippery, lots of lines on the road, and critically, he broke his shoe fastening, and there was a kind of nervous time where he was trying to break off the shoe fastening. With one yank as he crossed the finish line with a lap to go, he managed to do it, and he soloed to victory. Wout van Aert following in his wake, in second place, Tadej Pogacar in third, Mads Pedersen fourth. Should say Matt Dinham of Australia, who was in that break, a very good seventh place, and Alberto Bettiol probably deserved a little bit more than 10th, but a very worthy world champion.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Well, indeed, a worthy world champion, Lionel. Not an unexpected world champion. We talked about the similarity of this course to a cyclocross course. Effectively, seven cyclocross courses, or seven cyclocross races, one after the other, effectively. You know, just looking now at Van der Poel's palmarès, it was interesting, wasn't it, in his post-race interviews, the way he talked about, he talked in terms of sort of completing his palmarès. This is, of course, his first senior world title. He won the junior world title 10 years ago, wasn't it, in Florence? He's won five cyclocross world titles, Roubaix, San Remo, Flanders, Amstel, Strade Bianche. He's won a Tour de France stage, had 6 days in yellow, of course, Giro stage, 3 days in pink, three mountain bike cross-country World Cup wins. And he's riding the mountain bike race this week, is he not?
Indeed, yeah. Could double up.
He could. And I suppose, Lionel, this really, well, consolidates his status as the best one-day rider of the current generation. I don't think there's too much doubt about that. So there have been, you know, we've sort of oscillated between different riders as to who is, of all of these, you know, fantastic riders that we've got in the current generation, who is the absolute sort of alpha, the kind of apex predator, and Pogacar is the rider that is most commonly described in sort of generic terms as the best cyclist in the world. But I think in terms of one day races, classics, Van der Poel should take that throne, should take that crown now. And I don't know about you, but I felt that of those four riders, and I'll come on to Mads Pedersen in a minute, because if anyone deserved to finish on the podium of those four, it was probably Mads Pedersen, with the, you know, the Danes kind of arrived on the Glasgow circuit in hazmat suits, toting blowtorches, and it was quite extraordinary the way they went about the start of the circuit part of the race. But I think Van der Poel rode, I mean, we've talked in the past about him not economical. I thought he was the most economical of those four. He did put in one sizable attack earlier on in a very active phase of the race between sort of 1970 kilometers to go. But Pogacar had his face in the wind a lot. Van Aert also put in several accelerations, although he also was supported by teammates for most of the race. You know, he had Tejs Benoot for a long period, and I thought the Belgians, I mean, there will be talk about the Belgians not riding harmoniously, and I'm sure, you know, Renard will be able to tell us in the coming weeks and months whether the sort of beef or the tension there was between Remco and Wout van Aert will flare or has flared again as a result of what happened today. I thought they played the cards that they knew they had. Philipsen, with hindsight, might not have been the best guy to sort of bring as a third prong to the trident. With hindsight, it looks relatively obvious that he wasn't going to contend. I mean, it was, if you look at the stats, it was by far the most selective World Championship road race of the last 20 years. 12 riders only within 5 minutes of the winner. The next closest to that was 65 riders within 5 minutes of the winner in 2014, and no other World Championship really comes close. So Philipsen was never really at the races, but I thought the Belgians rode a decent race. That said, going back to my original point, Van der Poel looked like a man who had realised pretty early on that he was the strongest man in the race and that he was going to pick his moment, the right moment, and that's what he did. And I don't really think any other riders can have too many regrets about how they approach things, because the strongest rider finished first, the second strongest finished second, and so on and so on.
Yeah, I mean, the Belgians will face a little bit of criticism because that goes with the territory, and they did have the five riders in play until very deep into the race, didn't they? Remco Evenepoel, and Wout van Aert, of course, but Tejs Benoot, Nathan van Hooijdonk, and Jasper Stuyven all in there as well. And I said in the preview, and I don't want to sound wise after the event, but it did play out this way. The simplicity or the lack of complexity when it came to Mathieu van der Poel and his chief teammate, Dylan van Baarle, who was there, but didn't really kind of go in and move. You know, he might, the conventional wisdom might have been get Van Baarle up the road with in that kind of phase where the race went into its lull, perhaps even do the kind of the Bettiol move, because I mean, obviously Bettiol was playing Italy's one and only card there, which was a big gamble. I mean, fair play to him, he put absolutely everything into it, and for 33 kilometers he had the whole race chasing him, and he made the race for Van der Poel as much as anything. You know, the Dutch didn't play the other card that they had, and the Belgians were in this position where they had that embarrassment of riches almost. And yes, the question of whether Remco Evenepoel or Wout van Aert was the number one protected rider, I think we had that question answered fairly early on, because Evenepoel was the first to sort of open things up. But sometimes having numbers and outnumbering everybody else makes it more complicated, not less. I mean, witness the way the Danes rode once it was down to Mads Pedersen and Matthias Schilmoser, because, you know, very simple for them as well as the Dutch. So, yeah, I don't think you can criticise the Belgians too much, but I do think the key question is the moment they caught Bettiol on that slight climb, it gave Van der Poel the opportunity to hit them immediately. And there was no kind of catching Bettiol, giving Bettiol a chance to sit on the wheel. I mean, he was blown out the back more or less straight away. But it was the absolute perfect kind of convergence of circumstance for Van der Poel. 22.5 kilometres to go, so not a crazy distance. If he could get a gap, get through a corner or two, suddenly everybody chasing behind. And as we saw, you know, it was treacherous. Van der Poel obviously went down, but chasing in a group when everyone's riding on the wheels, everyone's, you know, getting tired, being out in front is a huge advantage. But I do wonder if they caught Bettiol perhaps on a flatter section or, you know, not on a Van der Poel launch pad, it might have been quite a different way that it played out over the last 20-odd kilometres.
I think the way the gap went out and continued to go out, though, would suggest strongly that Van der Poel was not only the strongest rider in that group, he was by far the strongest rider. And I sort of think
But would he have attacked on the flat? Would he have made the same effort on the flat?
He would have gone somewhere. He would have gone somewhere. And I think he would have got away. The eventuality of it finishing in a sprint, it was pretty obvious that that wasn't going to occur, because it was very obvious how exhausted, how on their knees those four riders were. The three riders, Van Aert, Pogacar and Pedersen. And even after Van der Poel's crash, there wasn't really too much suspense, was there? He looks as though he was down for a good 10 or 15 seconds, and I was sort of mentally, I was calculating that, you know, he would probably have 10 seconds now advantage or 15 seconds advantage, and they would probably be able to see him. That wasn't the case. So in fact, I think the time gaps were slightly misleading. I think he probably had more than the 26 or 27 seconds that we were seeing on the screen at that point, and more like 40. And that quickly went back out again, and then it went to over a minute. Just going back to the Belgians, Lionel, with about 90 kilometres to go, it looked as though Remco Evenepoel wasn't on a good day and he wasn't going to be in contention at all. And he kept getting sort of distanced or sort of dawdling in the really technical part of the course, which is also slightly uphill around the Kelvin Grove sort of art gallery and around the kind of university. And then he was revived somehow from about 60 kilometres to go, and then he put in a couple of his sort of trademark moves, and it did look as though he might, give us an action replay of what he did last year in Wollongong. Then the rain started, and it seemed to sort of exacerbate whatever technical difficulties he was having holding the wheels on, particularly on those intricate sections. However, I think the bottom line there as well was that he wasn't on a particularly great day. And in his post-race interview, I noticed as well, I heard that him saying that it just wasn't a course that suited him. He's not explosive enough, and it was the most explosive riders that eventually, ultimately won out. And on Van Aert, obviously this reinforces the narrative about the sort of irony of him now being the Poulidor in this rivalry with Van der Poel. Van der Poel, of course, Raymond Poulidor's the eternal second, the eternal runner-up's grandson. Van Aert's record of second place is now, of course, he's also won an awful lot, second place in the Olympic Games road race, twice in the Worlds now, twice in the Worlds time trial, four times in the World Cyclocross Championships, although he's also won a couple of those. He's also finished second to Van der Poel in the World Junior Cyclocross Championships and European Championships a couple of times as well. L'Equipe this morning, slightly cruelly, they called Van Aert the predictions world champion, i.e. the man who's always predicted to win huge races and has unfortunately fallen short, not far short, but slightly short on many occasions. But it's unfortunate, isn't it? Because his consistency is extraordinary. His repertoire is extraordinarily wide. And yet, he just happens to be riding in this time with this generation of riders where sort of everyone has one ability that in which he's sort of the second best, or he one ability that's slightly superior to him. And, I found myself wondering if they'd gone to the finish in a group as well, whether again he might have been the bridesmaid beaten by Mads Pedersen or Van der Poel. And that's just it's part of the sort of beauty of this generation, that they are so versatile, and I guess he just has to keep trying, doesn't he?
You are listening to Arrivé by the Cycling Podcast.
Well, Lionel, we knew we'd probably be talking about the weather in this World Championships. It's a bit of a cliche when it comes to Scotland, isn't it? And we talked about it the other day, how much rain falls in Scotland, how rotten the summers can be. Not always, we should stress. However, climate and climate change were topics of discussion and topics of heated, if you'll excuse the pun, debate today, weren't they, at the World Championships? Why, Lionel?
Well, that's because the race was brought to a halt for almost an hour by some protesters apparently cementing or gluing themselves to the road. It took a while for them to be removed. An organisation, as I said, called This Is Rigged, took responsibility for the protest. We didn't see too much of it on our TV screens, which is, I think that's significant in itself. I mean, first of all, sport has become a target for another organisation called Just Stop Oil, who have targeted a number of high-profile sporting events. And, of course, there is a significant movement, a groundswell of protest against fossil fuels predominantly, and in this case, fossil fuels specifically. And as I said, the British Prime Minister had very recently announced that a large number of licenses to explore for new oil and gas fields around Scotland would be issued. And I suppose that made the road race or the World Championships in general a target for protesters. Now, we don't want to go on and on about this, but I do sympathise with people who just want to watch the sport. You know, it's their hobby and they want to sit down and watch the race and don't want to have it disrupted, delayed for an hour. You know, it's a little bit inconvenient. But I also think that the protesters have a right to make their point. The argument that we should keep politics out of sport is especially difficult when it comes to a World Championships, because World Championship sport is political. You know, public money is involved in bidding for and hosting these events. A World Championships is, by its very nature, a commercial and political event. It's contested by national teams and, you know, there is a sense of national prestige attached to that. And then if you drill down into the detail, sorry, that's a poor pun, British Cycling is sponsored by Shell, an oil company. The Belgian team are sponsored by Esso. You know, there is a lot of oil and gas sponsorship in professional cycling. And I suppose you lose the argument that sport is not political when the British Home Office denied or delayed visas for Eritrean riders such as Biniam Gamai and his teammates. So, you know, I'm kind of fairly sanguine about protests as long as it doesn't, you know, cause an incident that endangers the riders or spectators. If people want to glue or cement themselves to the road at their own risk, well, that's their own risk. You know, it does seem like the race itself had plenty of warning. It wasn't like they suddenly jumped out in front of the peloton. You know, that's certainly something that, you know, would instantly attract the opprobrium of everyone watching. But I suppose the other point I would make is that as an event that is basically the broadcast rights are sold by the UCI, and there will be presumably sort of stipulations regarding, you know, what should and shouldn't be shown on screen. I just think that we're kind of abandoning journalistic principles by not showing what's going on. You know, it's the big story of that hour, you know, what actually is happening. And I understand that, you know, they won't want to encourage copycat protests. I also understand that, you know, that the flavour of protest is perhaps more in line with I guess, my worldview than another type of protest. So I guess there's a sense of sort of hypocritical thinking there. I could be open to that accusation. But, yeah, the race was delayed for an hour. And I think that, you know, peaceful protest, even if it's disruptive, you know, people do have a right to make their point in that way if that's how they see fit.
It's a cornerstone of most democracies, isn't it? Peaceful protest. Can I be extremely glib for a minute, Lionel? Was it Mappe cement? And if so, are we sure this wasn't guerrilla marketing, given that Mappe are a very prominent sponsor of the UCI World Championships?
I think that would be an extraordinary double bluff by the protesters.
And by the UCI, perhaps.
Yeah, well, you know, jokes aside, I mean, cycling is kind of uniquely vulnerable, isn't it? I mean, I know we've seen people get onto cricket pitches and tennis courts and football pitches. And I think there was a protest where somebody chained themselves to the goalpost at a Premier League game. Cycling is kind of uniquely vulnerable in the sense that the road is accessible at all times. And I think that's where I'd be really cautious about you know, there is a very clear line between what is a peaceful, safe protest and what eventually endangers what is a fast moving, slightly unpredictable sport. I mean, people running into the road or, you know, again, there's got to be a sort of sense of understanding of what a bike race is in order to protest at it safely,
yeah,
I guess.
I don't know how much the protesters have thought about this, but there is something sort of almost kind of poetic, or you could say ironic, about the fact that the only way you can stop a bike race is actually by stopping the motor vehicles. The bikes can actually continue. I mean, the peloton could have... they could have walked around and the race could have continued without any delay whatsoever. And as I say, symbolically, I suppose there's something apt in the fact that by stopping the motor vehicles, they've stopped the bike race.
Well, that point was specifically made on the ground. The riders were asking, you know, can we not just go past? And they were told, yes, you could go past, but none of the vehicles can get past. And so I suppose that's the kind of the big conflict in a sport like professional cycling. You know, cycling as a mode of transport is green and should be encouraged. And the World Championships being in Glasgow, or the World Championships, or the Tour de France, or whatever, plays a huge role in encouraging people to get into cycling, either for sport and for their own health and fitness, or for you know, green travel. And so, you know, there are all of these kind of side arguments. You know, you couldn't have a carbon fiber bike frame without the oil industry. You couldn't have a bike tire without the oil industry, and so on. I just think these are slightly red herring arguments when there is a bigger picture argument to be made by the people who want to make it. But yeah, I think there is some symbolism there. The bikes could have got through, the cars couldn't.
Lionel, should we talk about some more cycling?
Yes, let's. What about the circuit, Daniel? I mean, we joked, well, Lawson Craddock said it, so that gets us off the hook. The World Criterium Championships. And as I said, you know, Britain has got a fine tradition of criterium racing. There was a sense, for me at least, that perhaps there were a few too many laps, maybe a bit more racing in the open countryside before getting to the city centre. As a TV spectator, probably would have been better. But then you've got to think of the, you know, the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, probably, of people on the roadside enjoying the spectacle in Glasgow city centre.
There is a bit of snobbery about this as well, isn't there? In the sense that, well, Glasgow has its own tradition, as most cities in the UK and indeed Europe do, that it has a tradition of bike racing. It may not be, you know, it's not Antwerp or Amsterdam, but you know, it's produced riders, it's held events before. But you know, the UK is still, especially the north part, or the Scotland, is a bit of an outpost as far as the heartlands of European professional cycling are concerned, and also just the sense that this is not what many of us think professional cycling should look like. And it's not the reason that a lot of us do ride bikes. We ride it to escape urban environments. We ride bikes to escape urban environments. If we were in Scotland, for example, as you were last year on the Tour de Corse, the great draw of that is to glory in the wonderful scenery and landscape that is available in Scotland, which the race did in its first half, essentially. But a criterium, what is essentially a criterium, sort of jars with that, doesn't it? There were other, I think, legitimate, genuine concerns. We saw when the rain did start how dangerous it could be, that circuit. And I think it would have been extremely dangerous if we'd had rain for the duration of the race this afternoon. And the road surfaces were not great. I think they were pretty typical of UK roads, but it was a bit of a shock to the system for some of the riders when they arrived last week. You know, there was some sort of mirth about the general reaction of the French riders in particular. There was this sort of a bit of an out of context quote from Florian Sénéchal. He said it's a shitty circuit. He sort of then went on to clarify that he meant that it wasn't, you know, a typical world championship circuit. Benoît Cosnefroy suggests that it had been designed in a pub. And that was his initial reaction. And then later on, he sort of qualified that and said, actually, you know, I really like this circuit because it favors explosive riders and I'm an explosive rider. Cosnefroid actually did a pretty good job setting up Valentin Madouas, although it was a pretty awful day for the French generally. Christophe Laporte had a problem. He was their leader and he had a mechanical problem, which really, well, made it impossible for him. And any rider really who had mechanical problems today was out of the running immediately, weren't they? And that was another sort of peculiarity. It's another thing that sort of jars with our kind of dogmas, our kind of received knowledge about what a bike race is supposed to look like. But that didn't make it boring. On the contrary, it made it incredibly exciting. And what is the sort of the touchstone that I don't necessarily hold as dear as some other people, but most people cling to this idea that the strongest rider should win every race. And I don't think anyone could doubt that that was the case today. And it was a circuit. It was a circuit in addition to the way that it was raced and the way that it was interpreted, but it definitely was conducive to the strongest rider winning. So in that sense, it was almost the perfect World Championship road race. I mean, I did see some of my Italian friends on Twitter in the sort of last hour of the race and soon after the race suggesting this should become a permanent sort of World Tour classic, the Tennent Super Race. We should have a 270-kilometer race on the same circuit every single year.
I mean, Benoît Cosnefroid finished 47th out of 51 riders, so he went the distance, presumably trying to avoid us getting to the bar too early, maybe this evening. I don't know.
Would you agree with that snobbery, Lionel? Would you agree?
I do, actually. Yeah, and I'm possibly guilty of it myself because there's this hangover from those criteriums. You know, they played a big part in me getting into cycling in the first place. The sort of Friday night evening criterium sponsored by Kellogg's, held in a British city centre on, let's be clear, a very different circuit because generally be a sort of kilometre or a kilometre and a half circuit. But, you know, watching the British crit riders barrel around those corners, you know, right turn, right turn, right turn again, and then have a sprint at the end. I remember one in Cardiff that went through the castle grounds and sort of, you know, Stephen Roach was off the front. But there was this kind of aspect of theatre to those races, you know, a crit race, a bit like the kind of the post-tour criteriums that used to happen in France and Belgium and Holland just after the Tour de France in the 80s and before. So there was this kind of sense that they weren't proper races, I suppose.
Or a different discipline within the wider discipline of professional cycling. But let's not forget, they do have their own, they almost have their own, well, they have their own world championship. It is almost a sport within a sport.
Indeed. Yeah, well, there's a British Criterium Championship. And of course, you know, in Britain, it was a proper sport. You know, it wasn't an exhibition race like it was in Europe in August back then. You know, I can remember anecdotes from, you know, Belgian riders coming over and saying to Sean Kelly, you know, okay, so what's the drill? You know, who's going to win? Who's going to be in the break? You know, and Sean Kelly sort of shaking his head and saying, no, it doesn't work like that here. This is a proper race. And they will, you know, they will race from the gun. In terms of sort of just looking at the course and the roads particularly, I mean, when the rain started falling, you know, the manhole covers and the lines on the road. I mean, there was a big yellow cross hatch bit at the bottom of one of the climbs where they were doing the right hander. I was just kind of wincing at just how slippery they can become, because even when we were riding around Glasgow on our Tour de Coste last year, we actually came into the city on a very wet day. We had to make our way from, if memory serves correctly, Ibrox, home of Glasgow Rangers, up to Partick Thistle, and it was hammering down with rain, and, you know, the puddles formed in the potholes, and you know, the roads felt slippery under the tyres. So, you know, but that's no different really to the Champs-Élysées. If you get any rain on the Champs-Élysées on the final day of the Tour de France, everyone is nervous about how slippery it will be. But I guess there's a difference when a world title is on the line. But I suppose the proof of the course being a success is that from about 50, 60 kilometres out, it was clear that the winner was going to be one of the best one-day riders in the world, one way or the other. And that's the whole point of the race, really. And I'd much rather have that than, you know, there have been some absolutely, you know, wretched world championship
courses. Well, I was thinking about this.
The last 20-odd years. Yeah, I mean, I remember Hamilton in Canada, not a great course, not a great winner, for example. I mean, that might be... a little bit unfair.
It's been a while ago now. We've been collecting his Friends of the Podcast money for the last 8 years, and you and you poo-poo his finest hour like that. I was going to ask you about this. I should interject, first of all, that I don't think there is a World Critérium Championship. I think I've got that completely wrong. For some reason, I thought...
There's certainly a British one.
I think there are national championships in a lot of countries. But just thinking back to World Championship, that... World Championships of the last 20 years. You mentioned a couple of sort of stinkers there, just kind of visually as well. And, you know, that's important. We always talk about the sort of aesthetics of races, the light quality sometimes. Ponferrada, I remember being a really strange one. It was a very strange place to hold the World Championships, this small city in Galicia, and there were all sorts of kind of slightly murky kind of reasons as to why Ponferrada had the World Championships anyway. But I can remember that race kind of went through or around the quarry, and it all just being very sort of cycling out of context. And there have been some others as well, strange ones. But, you know, when I think of the best ones, the ones I've enjoyed most, they haven't been, strictly speaking, circuits in the sort of traditional sense. The Innsbruck one, I think, was one everyone enjoyed. But again, you know, that had a lot to do with the sort of the optics of it. It was a beautiful day. It was what people expect Innsbruck, a city in Austria, to kind of look like. I think Leuven was fantastic. Because of the Belgian crowds, and it was a really interesting circuit as well, and a sort of, you know, climbs that lent themselves to, well, a sort of stadium atmosphere. But, you know, what is the perfect World Championship circuit? You know, I mentioned that kind of that template of the circuit with one landmark climb or two landmark climbs, but, you know, that became so predictable, particularly in this kind of noughties, year after year, where you would sort of a host city would announce the route and you would look for the one big climb, and everything had to happen on that climb or else you would get a bunch sprint, and that got very, very boring. In the last 10 years or so, we've seen the cards shuffled a little bit more and a few more interesting routes whereby it's often point to point, starting one city, finishing another, with some form of circuit, but not even always the same circuit repeated time after time after time. So what is the perfect route?
It's a good question. I think actually getting away from just laps has been a good trend. And I think mixing it up, I think there's no problem with having a circuit that suits different types of riders, that looks different, that keeps us all guessing. I suppose I'm talking with a sense of hindsight here, because as I say, at around about sort of what, 3 o'clock this afternoon, I was feeling slightly uncertain. I didn't really know what I was watching, and I suppose, you know, the way it's all you know, the way it all shook down was kind of reassuring to me, in that it wasn't a kind of a race that we couldn't explain in a way. And I suppose there's something about that as well. You know, we've often talked in the past about the races that lead up to the men's elite road race give us some clues about what to expect. And we've had a little bit less of that this time. And there's not, I mean, even in the run up to the race, people were unsure. Renart was saying in our preview, he had no real idea what to expect. I mean, had it come down to a bunch sprint of say 50 riders, obviously now we've seen the race, now we've seen the impact the circuit had, you know, that was never going to happen. But there was a point when just looking at the map, just looking at the roads, you know, that was a possibility. So I suppose it's about just, you know, being unfamiliar with the outcome. But then it's all completely vindicated by the identity of the riders that came to the fore and the way that Van der Poel won it, which was exceptional and well worthy of wearing the rainbow jersey for the next 12 months.
And I think the crowds line up, and also the sense that the race did take place in the heart of Glasgow, and it also took over Glasgow in a way that other world championships in other big cities has not. I mean, you know, when I think back to those world championships, the noughties, you know, the first one that I went to, Lisbon in 2001, it sort of took place on a park outside the city. No one in Lisbon would have even known that it was happening. And we've had that often. Even the Florence Worlds, I mentioned the one that Van der Poel won as a junior 10 years ago, you know, it's sort of mouthwatering when you hear there's a world championships taking place in one of the great cities of Europe, but then when you don't see any of the iconic landmarks, then it sort of loses some of its luster. And at least with Glasgow, I did feel as though, well, it crisscrossed the centre of Glasgow and gave people a very good idea of what Glasgow looks like and almost sort of feels like viscerally.
I suppose, in summary, Daniel, a very worthy world champion, a podium that really reflects where we are in 2023. And, you know, when I look at the results and see that 51 riders actually finished, that surprised me, because it looked like the race was down to kind of, you know, a dozen riders and, half a dozen riders, really. It didn't feel like a race that, you know, these guys were off the front and then there was a sort of group of 50 riding in, because there just wasn't. I mean, even those riders outside the top 25 were broken up into groups. And I think that also says a lot about the nature of the course and just what a hard day of cycling it was for them.
I don't know if you saw, Lionel, there were a couple of clips online, one of Tadej Pogacar sort of staggering off the bike and towards the podium area, literally having to be held up. He was so sort of dizzy. I don't know if you noticed him looking...
But I think that was all the corners.
Yeah, that's possibly true. I don't know if you saw him, or it might have been the Tennant Super. It might have been the local brew that he'd already sampled. At one stage, I did wonder whether Alberto Bettiol had a bit of a pit stop somewhere on the route, because his trajectories were getting quite erratic around some of the bends on the last lap. Lionel, I don't know if you saw Pogacar as well, as he came over the line on with one lap to go for the bell lap. He sort of looked back. I think the arch over the finish line tells you how many laps to go, doesn't it? And I think that may have been just to check how many were indeed to go. And then as he was waiting for the podium presentation, he said to the UCI president, David Lapartient, he sort of put two fingers up and said it was two laps too many, jokingly. but yeah, absolutely brutal. But Lionel, I think 50% of the fun of the World Championship is in the various sort of inquests that take place in every national team in the hours and days after the road race, and which we will have over the next few days. They'll start over the next few days. We mentioned Belgium. The Italians are always great at it. The French have got a lot to talk about. Great Britain had a bad day, really bad day. I think a lot of people expected Fred Wright to be a contender, an outsider. On today's course, and he abandoned pretty early. So it'll be interesting to hear what the story of their day was, which we will, no doubt.
Well, maybe we'll check in with Renard again and find out what the story was from the boys in blue.
Indeed. Lionel, we'll be back, won't we, later in the week?
We will indeed, Daniel, yes. By the sounds of it, a Tennent's this evening.
Tennent's? I've never had a Tennent's Super, but maybe tonight's the night.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb and Lionel Burney.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.